This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Part 2 of December 29th, God's Green Kingdom.
It's remarkable to talk to academics about reading. In my days teaching undergrads, I would teach them to read. Thought they'd know that when they got to Emory University, but I would have to teach them to read, particularly given the volume of reading, and I'd have to teach them to read in a fractal way, at multiple scales, teach them how to skim an article or a book, and understand the big picture before they plunged into the details. And I think that some of what we have to do as we look at God's world is to understand it at multiple scales, and to think about the world that we encounter personally, on the scale of individual lives lived out in ecosystem-sized landscapes. And we also have to think about building a community that can, with trust, be called upon to say things about the earth and the way it works at larger scales as well. And I think that because there's been a divide in recent years, starting probably in the 1800s with the professionalization of science, a real denigration of amateur attempts to understand creation, the country parson who is an avid naturalist and observer and whose journals now form some of the bulk of climatological research around the world, knowing when ponds first froze and when they thawed and knowing what temperatures were daily throughout the year. I mean, there's a lot of amateur science that now winds up, for historical reasons, being very important. But scientists, as they professionalized, began to separate themselves from those country parsons, from the amateur attempts to do science. And Alistair McGrath says that that was also a beginning of the sort of conflict between science and religion, this great divide which we feel like people like Richard Dawkins like to continue to cultivate and stir the pot about, but which is probably nowhere near as dramatic as he suggests. But that began in that attempt to distinguish professional science from amateur science. So I want to make a case to you who are professional scientists and scholars and researchers and professional architects and those in training for those disciplines, that I think one of our main jobs, and I'll cut to the chase of reading science, is to teach the church again, and in so doing teach American society how to read the book of creation, to understand that God's revelation to us comes to us in the book of Scripture, the special revelation to us, but it also comes in this general revelation of the world around us. My friend Tim Kies is a LaBrie baby, whose father, Dick Kies, runs the LaBrie in outside Boston. And he wrote this in our journal, Creation Care, about some reflections he had about the two books of nature. He said, "It struck me as odd that while it would be unthinkable for Christian parents to ignore teaching their children about the Bible, it's commonplace for them to ignore teaching their children about the created world. In contrast, the author of the Reformed Belgic Confession suggests that the first direct means by which we know God is by the creation, preservation, and government of the universe, since that universe is before our eyes like a beautiful book in which all creatures, great and small, are as letters to make us ponder the invisible things of God, his eternal power and his divinity, as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1:20. Tim goes on to write, "If that's true, then our failure to connect our children to creation is more than a small oversight." Then he writes, he goes on to say, he thought also about the motivation for actions of creation stewardship, about the need to move beyond guilt, fear, and a sense of duty, to think of love as a stronger motivator for creation care, that God delights in his creatures. Job 39 and Psalm 148 tell us, how can we share God's attitude toward his creatures if we pay them no attention? He says, "Christian stewardship functions best when it arises organically from a genuine love and delight in the creation, but this passion is not self-generating. It must instead be cultivated." And the last thing he writes, as an ornithologist, he said, "It's become clear that good theology alone, while necessary, is not sufficient to making good decisions about creation stewardship. How can we tend and keep systems that we do not understand? If we can't tell a Kirtland's warbler from a goldfinch, or what either of them need to survive, how are we to make sure that the endangered Kirtland's warbler doesn't go extinct?" I saw this recently when I was walking through a Washington, D.C. park with a young colleague who works for my own organization. And I asked him about some of the birds that we saw on our walk, just to get a passing sense of his ecological literacy. We pass by a northern mockingbird, a mourning dove, and a northern cardinal. Birds that you're probably very familiar with, none of which he could name. Someone who has now dedicated his life and is spending his career to fighting global warming, to helping the U.S. pass rational policies to deal with our global warming pollution, who understands the connection between social justice and environmental concern, had not even a passing acquaintance with God's creatures that surround him every day. Needless to say, he didn't know what those animals ate, what their ecological roles were, or whether their populations were increasing or decreasing. He didn't know the names of any of the native trees we encountered on our walk either. The fact that most of us in this room could name trees that were actually and give them their specific epithets is a rarity, I think, in the church, as we've increasingly become divorced from our agrarian forebears. Now, less than 2% of the people living on the land and making a living directly from the land, very few of us encounter nature in the way that builds a sense of community and relationship anymore. Stephen and I recently spoke together at a conference in Tennessee, which featured the prominent environmental writer Holmes Ralston III, a philosopher and ethicist. He asked whether it was possible for society to move from respect for the environment to reverence. That would be a powerful shift, but one participant noted that some of the most important work was going to be done by moving society to a precursor step, which is regard. It was Robert Kingsolver, a botanist. He asked us to begin by looking at creation. Not a small step. It's not easily accomplished, but it can be used as a building block. And it has to be used as a building block, because most of us no longer spend much time in the created world. Sad to say, even folks working for environmental nonprofits, environmental education organizations, spend most of the time behind a computer administering those programs. But we live instead in a kind of newosphere, entirely of our own artifice. Many of us, even devoted devotees to creation care activism, wouldn't notice if our society was transplanted to a space station. Like in the movie WALL-E, who has seen that? Brilliant movie, you should watch it in your churches. And fellowship groups. We wouldn't notice we were transplanted to a space station as long as there were shopping malls, flat screens of various types, and access to that vast wasteland of food that occupies the aisles and not the edges of most grocery stores. Second, after we do encounter physical creation itself, we are left with the task of managing it. And as has been said, it's extraordinarily complex. Much of the knowledge that's necessary for managing complex systems is in danger of being lost because it exists in the minds of people who actually live close to the land, and not in the disembodied industrial knowledge of how to run a giant tractor or manage the chemical applications that are necessary for the way agriculture is often done now, which is without regard to the land. This knowledge exists more in the domain of cultural anthropologists than in households or farmers or ag extension services. Since most of us are unused to complexity except in the technological domain, we're simply baffled by the science necessary to understand environmental problems. I say we as a church, not we in this room, because I hope that some of us in this room hold the keys to educating our brothers and sisters. So I think that there's two steps in cultivating a radical reading of creation and cultivating a high regard for this physical material world. One is simply to encounter it. People can still be awestruck by the beauty of creation, and those kind of encounters make them resistant to claims that nature is simply a consumer good that we'll get around to consuming when we've got enough wealth built, or that it's a place to recreate, just one consumer good among many of consumer goods on a menu. Fresh air, sunshine, good food, biological diversity touch something primordial in our nature, and it's something that's appreciated by both Christians and sociobiologists like E.O. Wilson, albeit explained in very different ways. Something about loving God is stimulated in encountering his handiwork. Further, encountering creation inevitably means uncovering inequities and injustices in the distribution of environmental goods and environmental bads. Encountering creation means visiting not just wilderness areas, parks, and gardens, but inner cities, toxic waste dumps, denuded hillsides, and hospitals. These experiences also touch on something primordial when they offend us and hurt us deeply. Something about loving our neighbors as ourselves and being our brother's keeper are stimulated by those kinds of encounters. Alistair McGrath, again, I just really recommend the book you probably read years ago, and I hadn't until this year, The Reenchantment of Nature, contrasts the experience of nature with encounter with nature. One is looking, and one is building relationship. I think of my pastor, Leroy Barber, in inner city Atlanta, who wrote about the contrast between the initial experience of inner city life and the reading of the landscape that occurs as you live in it. Here's what Leroy writes. I live in an unjust American landscape. My church is composed of people who live in one of America's urban sacrifice zones. If you, as an outsider, sat down to list the social ills that are unequally visited on my neighborhood, you'd be able to name only a few of the most prominent: drug crime, addiction, prostitution, failing schools, broken homes, broken windows, lack of jobs, no public library, adult illiteracy, and homelessness would probably come to mind. Those aren't just individual injustices, they're social injustices, and they're geographic injustices. Whole regions of the city seem to be marked off for sacrifice, at least until upwardly mobile classes decide that it's time to gentrify them. That's from Creation Care magazine, Leroy Barber, summer of 2008. Environmental injustices likely wouldn't appear on your list. When visitors to inner city Atlanta think about environmental disparities compared to their own neighborhoods, they usually think first about litter. Litter is an environmental problem, and it's a sign of social disruption and lack of pride in place. But litter doesn't kill anyone. Within blocks of our church, there is a toxic waste treatment facility, a trash transfer station, chemical plants, paint plants, and other facilities that the EPA says release carcinogens and heavy metals like lead into the air. On almost any environmental measure, our area ranks as the worst 10% in the United States. The city, this is in Atlanta, the city's main tow lot for cars occupies the land that would be the neighborhood hub. The collective leaking oil seeping into the unpaved earth beneath these cars pollutes our groundwater and runs off into our streams. The city and county have permitted large freight operations and trucking operations to locate in what was once a dense, walkable, livable neighborhood, bringing with them reckless traffic and concentrated toxic diesel emissions. Pedestrian fatalities afflict African Americans at a rate 2.5 times that in the white population in Atlanta, largely because the state Department of Transportation doesn't design roads to accommodate walkers or cyclists. They see their job as moving cars in and out of Atlanta, which, by the way, Atlantans rack up vehicle miles every day that are equivalent to driving to the sun and partway back every single day, 95 million miles a day on the road. The Department of Transportation doesn't take any regard to the needs of neighborhoods that are sliced up by arterial roads. Hispanic Atlantans are in an even worse plight, concentrated in newer developments but still reliant on walking. They are killed by cars at rates 6 times higher than whites. These can't be considered accidents. They are predictable results of the way we build our cities. You know, Exodus talks about the ethics of what to do when your bull gets out and accidentally gores someone, in which case you have to stone the bull and not eat the meat, which I suppose is very important, not to eat that meat. If your bull is in a habit of goring and gets out and stones people, then the bull gets stoned, but so does the owner. And that's not being stoned in a good way. That is, there's a difference between the kinds of liability that come from something that's an accident and something that is not an accident. It's pretty predictable. Asthma from air pollution affects large and increasing number of kids in Leroy's, my inner city neighborhood. Nationwide, poor African-American children are twice as likely to have asthma as poor white children, and blacks are 3 times more likely than whites to be killed by asthma. When people opted for public transportation and telecommuting to keep traffic congestion down for 2 weeks during the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, the rate of emergency room visits and hospitalizations due to asthma fell by half. Controlled for all sorts of things like the weather, but this was voluntary efforts on the part of Atlantans to make it a nice place to visit during the Olympics. And the side effect of that was happy families that didn't stay up all night with the kids on nebulizers wondering whether or not to take them to the emergency room or not. Our neighborhood is one of the worst in the U.S. for lead paint in houses. Nationwide, over 20% of black kids in older homes suffer from lead poisoning, compared to just over 5% of white kids in older homes. But black kids are also far more likely to live in an older, dilapidated home. In some parts of the country, 1 in 3 inner city children suffers from lead poisoning. leading to lifelong problems like reduced IQ, slowed body growth, hearing problems, behavioral problems, and kidney damage. This is one that I can relate to because of trying to take my kids in this neighborhood down to get to a little bit of where nature is bursting forth, some of the stream systems and creeks that still cut through Atlanta. Antiquated sewer systems mean that high rainfall events bring floods of wastewater, toilet paper, tampons, and condoms through many of our inner city parks and streets. Dilapidated houses and apartments are havens for rats and roaches, which are themselves triggers for asthma. Landlords who, when they decide to treat for these pests, use whatever cheap chemicals they lay their hands on, often use agricultural chemicals, never used meant to be sprayed indoors. And then if you thought harder, writes Leroy, you'd realize that green space in parks, sidewalks and bike lanes, banks and grocery stores, restaurants and retail are also distributed unequally. Here's where what he writes takes on added salience for our discussion of reading the Book of Creation. The Bible says we're meant to take a lesson from the environment around us about what God is like. Romans 1 says God's eternal power and divine nature should be apparent from the creation. If kids in my neighborhood were asked to look at Metro Atlanta and describe what God is like, I don't think they'd get a vision of a Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. If all they had to go on was general revelation, their picture of God would be horribly skewed. They would see God's creation as a place that's more threatening to black and Latino families than to whites. Confronted with environmental threats so obviously distributed along ethnic and class lines, they might begin to imagine a racist God. This is from encountering the world and reading it and trying to get a picture for what God is like. You can't do that as a quick visitor. It often requires moving into the neighborhood, or at least developing some sort of plan for encountering nature on a regular basis. And that's not something that's easy to do in the American landscape. When I think about Mary-Kate Morse's story about driving home on a divided highway and turning into a housing development, it immediately established a particularly American kind of landscape, one in which you live in one place and shop in another place and work in and sleep in another place and work in another place. And she was in between two of those nodes in an automobile. And nowhere else but in America could you be surrounded by so many people and yet so utterly isolated that you could be having a barroom brawl on the side of a road with cars passing you by on both sides. There are other spaces for that kind of activity in other cultures. But in America, you can find that kind of isolation right in the middle of main transportation corridors because we're isolated in our vehicles. We're not encountering the world in the way that I think God seemed to design our bodies to encounter the world, which is on foot. New urbanists are discovering this, and I'm sorry, I was going to show a slideshow of some new urban ideas in Atlanta and some of why the landscape that we've developed isn't good for kids, but I decided, I think, to concentrate more on a short film that we'll talk about, reading the landscape, and then some group discussion. But there are folks like Eric Jacobson, who writes in Sidewalks in the Kingdom, about how the way we build our cities shapes our capacity for social engagement, our ability to encounter other people, and our ability to encounter the diversity of folks around them. You put a sign up that said, American landscape, wealthy, professionals over here, folks with decent middle-class jobs over here, folks with very few prospects for income should live over here. I mean, you see those signs every day in Atlanta where you, like, neighborhoods from the high 200s over this way and from the low 60s in this way. We're dividing up the landscape and segregating ourselves because of the automobile. It allows us to sort ourselves out on the landscape in larger patches in biogeographical terms. So that we don't encounter a diversity of folks and we're getting back and forth in cars. I have another slide, which is a beautiful slide of a typical suburban neighborhood in which you see habitats laid out there. I mean, I used to work for the National Wildlife Federation. We talk about backyard wildlife habitat. Lauren Wilkinson had some ideas about bringing creation to the backyard. You look at a suburban landscape, there is some habitat there for wildlife. And there's obviously habitat for people because that's what those houses are patched around on the landscape. But the main habitat in those sorts of landscapes is habitat for cars. And I mean, if you wanted to design as a population biologist the right kind of habitat to encourage large car populations, you would design those big curving streets so you set your steering wheel at a certain angle and never have to steer as you go around, and big wide streets and driveways going into the facades of houses, which are dominated by a garage and not by anything else. And then most of the living space that you think is habitat for people in those houses is actually habitat for automobiles. So it's great habitat for cars, and we build that kind of habitat, and they come and populate and reproduce and make more cars and fill the world up. And they're being very fruitful and multiplying and replenishing the American landscape. But listen, I think that this encounter with the world is one thing. The other step is to study it, and that's what most of in this room are doing. We're studying creation or manipulating it in enlightened ways. But I would like to propose that the church needs to be engaged, not just as scholars, but as interested amateurs. That we need to be thinking about motivating whole congregations and whole communities into gardening, bird watching, natural history, hunting, fishing. These are all lay versions of environmental scholarship. And in many societies, they constitute a domain of cultural knowledge. I think that those are forms of cultural knowledge that can form a bridge from an appreciation of the aesthetics of creation to an appreciation of the complexity that scientists, engineers, poets, writers, architects, and artists inhabit, the folks that are in this room. And we've got to do something about that. What happens if creation care stops with an appreciation of the scriptural injunctions to be good stewards? I think we become vulnerable to the extremes of manipulation there without an appreciation of complexity, of the ubiquity of unintended consequences, of issues of scale and size, the nature of variability and uncertainty. Our experience in this newest sphere sets us up for real problems in our encounter with real science. Gardening is a cure for people who have no sense of natural variability, who don't understand how averages relate to variance, and who don't know what risk means. Birding sets folks up to, as Cal DeWitt says, you know, First thing you should do if you're interested in caring for creation is put up a bird feeder. What wonderful advice, because you first start by experiencing and seeing and looking at nature, but then you start wondering why the birds are moving in and out with the frequencies and rhythms that they move in and out, and you know which beaks are able to use which kinds of food, and you start thinking about where those animals go when they're not in your backyard and they disappear for whole seasons of the year, and begin to get you in your mind around the sense of scale, and then possibly cause us to become better consumers of science that addresses those multiple scales. And maybe it will allow us to understand things like global climate change science in a way that's just not grounded in suspicion because we don't understand that. Scientists and scholars, you know, we're sometimes overly cautious in this regard. In our desire for careful communication and our zeal to avoid type 1 errors, we err on the side of caution in sounding any alarms at all. Hence, the classic definition of an environmental catastrophe, an effect so large that even an epidemiological study could detect it. Especially when an environmental problem demands action or has an implication for social justice, our sinful initial reaction is to discount it. And this impulse feels more justified if scientists appear uncertain. On the other hand, when scientists appear overly certain and magnify the dangers and move from science to popularization, there are other dangers that occur there. Lack of knowledge hasn't kept some Christians from weighing in on environmental issues or using blatant proof texting to argue against the possibility that people can damage the environment. I'll give you an example from that I first encountered when engaged in a live on-air radio debate with a prominent climate skeptic. My colleague used Psalm 104:9 to argue that sea level rise from global warming could never be a problem. In this passage, the psalmist, writing about the power of God, says, "You set a boundary for the seas that they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth." Also from Job 38:8-11, God saying, "It is I, God, who enclosed the sea with doors when, bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors, and I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves stop." This conservative author goes on to say that while our reading of these passages does not justify utter disregard of scientific debates about sea level, it does predispose us to believe that sea level rise is likely to be small and insignificant. Of course, no climate scientist, no oceanographer predicts that sea level rise will flood the entire Earth to the tops of the highest mountains. But some Christians, like my colleagues, have used the doomsday rhetoric of environmentalists to call into question the very basic science on global warming impacts. The author further justifies his proof text. I'm not suggesting that everyone should accept my interpretation and application of these passages. There is room for hermeneutical disagreement. But those Christians who, in considering these issues, ignore these passages, they deprive themselves of the input of the inspired Word of God when they ought instead to study it and believe it. The bumper sticker version of that is, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. This is not an example of respect for the revelation of God in creation, that is, for the radical reading of both the book of Scripture and the book of nature. Such armchair science is exactly that against which Augustine warned when he wrote in the literal meaning of Genesis. This is from Mark Knoll in The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. This is Augustine writing. Usually, even a non-Christian knows something about the earth, the heavens, and the other elements of the world, about the motion and orbit of the stars, and even their sizes and relative positions, about the predictable eclipses of the sun and moon, the cycles of the years and seasons, about various kinds of animals, shrubs, stones, and so forth. And this knowledge he holds to as being certain from reason and experience, from a reading of the natural world. Now it's a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an infidel to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense on these topics. And we should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up vast ignorance in a Christian and then laugh it to scorn. The shame is not so much that an ignorant individual is derided, but that people outside the household of the faith think that our sacred writers held such opinions. And to the great loss of those for whose salvation we toil, the writers of our scripture are criticized and rejected as unlearned men. Reckless and incompetent expounders of Holy Scripture bring untold trouble and sorrow on their wisest brethren when they are caught in one of their mischievous false opinions and are taken to task by those who are not bound by the authority of our sacred books. For then, to defend their utterly foolish and untrue statements, they will try to call upon Holy Scripture for proof and even recite from memory many passages which they think support their position, although they neither understand what they say nor the things about which they make assertion. They are quoting 1 Timothy 1:7. I used to read that kind of a passage and think that what is needed is more Christian environmental scholarship at the very cutting edge of science and research. And I think now that I've changed my mind about that, and that what is needed is more and more engagement and encounter with creation itself on the part of the entire church, and by extension, ordinary Americans. And we, as evangelicals, represent a lot of what the heartland of America looks and feels like. We represent in our attitudes, because we've been insufficiently culturally challenging, a lot of the attitudes that ordinary Americans have about science. And I think that what we need to do is work on bridging that divide now. We've actually got, we can't go for a Nobel Prize as a community in our understanding and engagement with science. We're looking for some sort of best improved award at this point. We're doing remedial work, I think, to bring many of our brothers and sisters into an engagement with creation so that they recognize the creatures God's made, they recognize God as revealing himself in creation, and they begin to trust that you can learn recognizable patterns, that science means something, and that scientists who include mass numbers of Christians are working on issues like endangered species, issues like water pollution, hydrologic cycle, drought, and climate change, are worth listening to and engaging in an intellectual conversation with about the most pressing topics of our day. And I think that it stems in large part from this fairly big distancing that's going on right now from our food systems, from our environment, from the world that we live in. So my injunction is for us to find ways and to think of ways, and the challenge at the end of the day will be to talk about this and to bring ideas for tomorrow about how we might help the church along in its engagement with creation and how to build healthier, happier families as a result as well. Some people have put the experience of doing short-term missions trips at the forefront of reasons why Christians now tend to be more concerned about the environment than they were before. That there's a critical mass of folks who've been overseas and been in challenging environments, And I want to show a short film about a missions trip, which is not not a trip to the developing world, but a trip to Appalachia, where some Christians, colleagues of ours, took a study tour and encountered what mountaintop removal mining looks like for coal mining. It's something that is often off-screen for most people that are consumers of electricity, but which is pretty shocking, and it constitutes a kind of reading. So I'd like to show this short film that was made. There's obviously a, you know, a kind of editorial bent to the filmmaker, and we can talk some about that. But I want to show it and get your reactions to it and see whether you think it might constitute one of the ways that we can read creation. And I think this is going to work.
Biblically understood as sin in Isaiah. sitting out today, the way I understand it, y'all got to fly over and see some of the things. You guys saw today what we see and have to deal with every day. And I look at the course, and not only is the heat retreat not there, where I came first word, the ridge is not there. Now, guys, that's to me, I mean, that's a very passionate issue.
In the evening, we bring in the folks whose lives have been affected, and we listen to their stories.
To be able to rip off the top of a mountain to get a 2 or 3 foot seam of coal is surely the example of greed in the purest, cold-hearted state.
What I've been down in the dumps as of late, and I see my friends and my neighbors lose their property. And the old home places that are so dear to them.
There's a verse on Proverbs 31:8 that says, speak out for those who cannot speak for themselves. And the goal for me is to be able to see firsthand so that when I speak with authority, that this becomes part of my story.
We get blood water and it was contaminated. You can't drink it, you can't use it to cook, but we don't have any other choice but to bathe in it. We got some testing done and it came back that it had high levels of arsenic in it. And my child was bathing in this water. I mean, she was trying to drink the bubbles in the water, you know, she doesn't understand that it's going to hurt her. She's just 3 years old.
Advantage of our church is that we have great fervor in our faith,
and we're also a church with a lot of political connections and a lot of economic might, and I think that's why we have a special role to play.
Oh, this world is one, the garden of my Lord, and he walks in his garden, in the
I'm going to grab at the break something that I have misplaced, which is the jacket for the DVD. It's a documentary made by the same documentary folks who did Eyes on the Prize for public television. And this documents eight different faith communities, from evangelical Christians, mainline Christians, the interfaith power and light movement, Buddhist community that is challenging consumer attitudes in California, Muslim community looking to consume sustainable meat for their Ramadan festival and building a neat relationship with a Christian organic farmer. And it's a great DVD to use in an interfaith dialogue setting on a college campus. It's called Renewal, and it's available online for not very much money. They're trying to actually distribute it pretty cheaply so people will use it to generate discussion. I will need to get the jacket and post the... There's a website you can order. I think it's $15, $20. And there's no... It's not one of these things where you pay $500 to show it to a group of 60 people. You're welcome to show your personal copy to as many people as you'd like to. The filmmakers work hard to represent a diversity of religious experience in America. It gives an example of one of these side effects, these externalities of our consumption of electricity that is just not visible unless you go and see it. And because everybody can't go and see it, there needs to be a way of cultivating a dialogue so that you can hear from the people who either study it or see it or visit it or have heard the testimonies. Again, it comes back to relationship and community building, I think, so that we can develop some discourses of trust that don't require all of us to experience something firsthand in order to know that there should be a reaction to it. What were your impressions about either the situation or the idea of reading the landscape in that way?
When you do something like this, I suppose your immediate reaction is that it is here. And I'll be surprised how could this be, so destructive and abusive. But it left me with a question. The question is, what is the relationship between economic development and environmental concern, the issue here? Is there a relationship? And the real question is there a responsible way to get a call from it? Or do you just need not know?
It's a good question. I have a background in natural resource economics, so we have a method of defining the right answer. We have a truth machine that we can put the right data into, turn the crank, and get a yes or no answer called cost-benefit analysis. But what it doesn't take into account is who gets the benefits and who bears the costs. So the justice dimension is not one that the discipline of economics has great tools for addressing. That requires a moral voice to begin to say whose interests count in doing cost-benefit analysis. But clearly there is balancing to go on. And what you see is folks, though, that I think jump to the conclusions that you'll either do no mining of anything ever, anywhere, and will, as critics of mine say, I want to go back to a horse and buggy times. Don't I realize what pollution that would mean to the streets of Chicago if all of that horse manure were accumulating day by day? And, you know, it's a kind of ridiculous statement. I don't think anybody would argue that there are corner solutions to these sorts of topics. But the idea that we should be able to consider side effects and make good, make people whole that suffer unjustly or without, or involuntarily from economic decisions that we make. It's something that Christian moral voice would certainly bring to bear on the discussion.
In this area that you portray in the movie, it's a relatively poor area. And so there's a lot of economic interest involved in keeping these kinds of animals going, if there's nothing else in the area that can keep people's jobs and families going. Now, most listeners of economics see themselves as descriptive, not money. But doesn't something like this, we realize the way this is a self-reinforcing situation, that there are all these vital interests of families and so on, jobs, that people find, don't have the responsibility to develop a different normative vision and begin to show people that there's a way of living sustainably on the earth and keeping people relatively in good shape economic and their families for life.
I think there are a lot of folks who would look at a situation like this and wouldn't be thinking about the livelihoods of the people. They would be thinking about the ecological habit that's really there. And again, as Christians who may be late to these conversations, but who have a concern for the flourishing of people who depend on resources for a living, I think we can bring a much better moral voice to bear on those problems than those who would just say this is a travesty against nature. We would see that there are balancing questions to be made. How do you allow for people to make a living? We're living in this context.
See, what this does is it shows something to people that are outside the situation and remarkable. Stop it. I think the people living close up, there are those people who are suffering very often. But the others who say, I have another alternative.
There's certainly, I'm not one of those folks who thinks that conservation and development always go hand in hand, that you are always able to take care of creation and maximize its fruitfulness while also providing for fruitful human development. I think that there are tensions and trade-offs to be made, but they ought to involve the people that are on the land and not just the corporations that happen to own the keys to the mine. And frequently, those are the voices that are heard in these kinds of circumstances. They're certainly the ones who have more of the trouble. This is driven almost entirely by government regulation. This kind of mining wouldn't happen in a free enterprise system. This only happens when governments give folks the permission to destroy property in ways that only governments, centralized governments, can allow. So this is created by regulation rather than something that's stopped by regulation. There are a combination of public lands and privately owned lands.
So,
mostly in the west, in the east, those lands are privately owned.
So those are privately, that is privately owned.
Right. The folks that, it's a careful distinction between whether you're protecting the public from harm or whether you're requiring those folks to provide a public good, but people depend on the ecosystem services that come from those mountains. They are watersheds for clean water downstream. People are endangered by consuming the pollution, the dust that settles in their homes. So controlling the externalities from an economic point of view would be the way that you talk about how the private rights of those landowners are balanced against the private rights of adjacent landowners and people in the communities.
And two things. One of the strange things of being at a conference like this is you very seldom get any news from outside. It's hard. You can't listen to radio. I thought I heard over the weekend that there was an incident where one of the retainment pods of one of the mining operations burst. And spilled a whole bunch of that gunk,
slurry,
And I wonder whether you
I haven't heard that from better access.
That's from the power plant, the coal-fired power plant, ash pond, the prison, all the spills.
So that's an externality from power production rather than from the extraction of the resource here.
The other observation I wanted to make is what we saw there was sand. It was seen. But we also need to realize that this is a region that for 100 years before they started doing this was one of the most oppressed economically, and one of the sites of the worst labor violence in the history of the United States. West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, coal mining was the source of some of the greatest mortality in the work and resultant attempts to unionize and resistance to unionization to the point of machine guns and the mines were deported. So it's important to be frustrated, to say something needs to be done, because it does. But we need to recognize that something needed to be done before too, and that the people that are going through this have been going through things like this for generations.
You know, that's a really good point. This kind of mining has fewer deaths per capita than underground coal mining.
Fewer deaths per
worker over time than underground coal mining. And a lot of the folks that are upset by this kind of mining were never upset by black lung disease. They were never upset by those obscene labor practices, the company towns that work workers deeper and deeper into debt in every passing year. So you're absolutely right. Again, it's a question of, can you be fully engaged in this sort of thing as a consumer of power? As a consumer of electricity, what do you need to know about where our connections are in the economy, about what the ramifications are of simple decisions we make about how much energy we use? And can you be part of that conversation? Can you feel responsible for it? And does knowing, does reading the landscape, does reading the natural world, reading the ramifications of our actions, help us to make better decisions about that? It makes me want to use less electricity. Makes me want to demand fewer resources from out of this region, and it should also make me want to demand that alternatives are worked out and provided for the folks that live there, who are depending right now on, some of whom are depending on coal generation for a living, but many of whom now have been put out of work since we've moved away from the kind of employment levels that were involved in underground mining to many fewer people involved in benefiting from this, much more of the profits now going into corporations rather than into any households in West Virginia. But there's been a lot of shifts over time. I showed this to a set of pastors in New York at a church planters conference, just to get the reaction to it. And what shocked me was that there wasn't any shock. The very first reaction out of the gate was, well, I don't suppose we have any alternatives. We need power. We need electricity. This is just one of the side effects. And there was a callous disregard for the idea that this is pretty sickening. We should at least recognize that there are serious side effects, serious consequences to the way we organize the economy. And then you might decide that you want to accept them, and that you think it's better to do this than not to do it. But not to have any revulsion at all, that you'd be doing these sorts of things on the landscape, was, I think, something that is a carefully cultivated attitude. It takes a long time to get folks to the point where they can't be revulsed by those sorts of sights. It takes a real discipline of the mind to avoid being repelled and shocked by the prevalence of asthma and traffic fatalities and pedestrian fatalities among kids in the central city of Atlanta. And Scott shared more about the fact that sometimes what we don't know, we prefer not to know. There's a discipline involved in disregard for these side effects, as well as a discipline in being able to balance which of those side effects to tolerate and which not to. And I think that more of that, we will overcome that negative discipline of ignoring these side effects by involving more people in creation, exposing more people to the beauty of what God has put out there, and also to some of these side effects, these dangers. It's all part of reading the landscape, reading what the opportunities are and what the dangers are for the way we organize ourselves.
Yeah, it's important to me. I think that you can do things in a messy, restrictive way, and you can do things in a much cleaner way. But as to China, I think that they seem to think that, well, they indoctrinate the people that with prosperity, you have like building factories and that brings pollution. When to me, you can have much cleaner factories, you can clean the smokestacks of the and the effluent that goes out, you can treat it much better. Like it's to mining, I'm not a mining engineer, but you know, one particular gold mine, gold and silver mine, and it's a big open cast mine, and it's going to be landscaped when it's finished. It's going to be a recreational lake. And I expect that lake to be quite nice when it's finished to use. But landfills end up becoming parks afterwards. I don't like the idea of landfills so much, or because you use a lot less, but you can still have a whole lot of time when they're finished and cause a whole lot less pollution. But you can do things in a cheap way or a better way in the first place. It seems this case kind of do as cheap as possible, and an environmental legislation system that lets them do it as cheap as possible.
Right, and the cheap way of doing things is often only financially cheap. It's not cheap for society, and I think that's the point to remember here, is that costs can still be imposed, but on folks that had no part in the transaction and that received none of the benefits from the transaction. And closing that loop, as economists would say, internalizing those externalities, is something that the church can advocate for, but also thinking, do those externalities fall on the most vulnerable and the most helpless and the most marginalized people in society? Do they deserve any special protection? And what's the role of the church in advocating for that? That's a question that's not often asked. Often the question is, do the sum of the benefits outweigh the sum of the costs? And if so, an activity will be permitted.
So with this particular type of mining, so it seems that...
Again, I don't want to get bogged down in this particular type of mining.
I'm just going to give an example.
Yeah, sure. Sorry.
So it seems like either there's push or is blasting to break up the dirt. Either it's pushed to the side or might use trucks to get it down instead of moving to one side and placing it back. And that keeping the topsoil separate and then spread over so that you don't have topsoil so that vegetation can't grow. But it could be done, even that could be done in a much better way, where you put the dirt back where it came from or put it back at the last mountain top.
Right. I mean, this overburden is not unconsolidated material. It's hard rock mining. And it's not, you don't reconstruct the mountain afterwards. And it's expensive to truck it all down somewhere where fill can be used, and what's cheapest is to push it over and to lower the high places and make level the low places. And,
yeah. So to me, I'm sure that you can do it in a better way that would cost more.
Yes. Or you could choose to do less of it or none of it, depending on what our needs for electricity are and our willingness to try to do things in a better way as end consumers.
I have two questions. One is, do you know the percentage of U.S. fuel consumption that comes from this kind of mining? And secondly, do you know these studies have been done over, because I was thinking for black lung and mine came and the loss of life from that versus the loss of life from that.
I don't know the statistics. I'm pretty sure fewer people die, fewer workers per year, per worker hour, die in this kind of mining. But there's very far fewer people employed in this kind of mining as well.
Yeah, and you've got people being affected by the mineral and arsenic who aren't a worker.
That's but, the whole population.
Yeah. So I was thinking that the total number of people with ill health or death versus the total number of people with ill health or death as a percentage or a rate. And no one in here knows the percentage of energy that comes from this table.
I don't know which comes from Eastern Kentucky or Tennessee.
From
Mount Top of the Mountain. Well, I was going to say, Christians for the Mountains, the organization that Alan Johnson featured in his film, has lots of the background information.
Christians
for the Mountains, which is the local church-based organization in this area. We have some of those data.
I'll end up with data that I would like to do my research. If I look at one particular thing, I could end up with three or four points from the past, where I'm from, which money means.
Right.
I was wondering how you suggest Christians should be doing all the things we've been talking about without becoming obsessive. I mean, in the sense that I had a friend who, you know, when I go shopping with them, you can't eat grapes.
Yeah.
You know, you can't eat processed sugar because your body's with the Holy Spirit. That's bad. But, you know, before long, you shrink what you can enjoy, and you're becoming paranoid about, I can't eat this, I can't do this. Electricity, I need not, you know, and then doesn't God want us to enjoy life to a certain degree, too? So without taking away anything of what you said.
I think you're absolutely right, and it feels like sometimes you're trading the pharisaical legalism that we struggle to shed as evangelicals and have a proclivity for a new kind of pharisaical legalism and sort of lack of enjoyment of anything in life. Debbie Downer is the sort of emblematic, you know, the one Christmas, Thanksgiving dinner says, you know, oh, this is really good turkey. Says, well, you ever been on a turkey farm? that you certainly get a lot of that, and what you don't get is a joyous sense that, wow, there are ways that we could tomorrow walk out as individuals and save 30% on our power bill by doing things smarter, and over time, if we start doing things smarter, could save 50 to 60 to 70% on our power bills and reduce our need for this kind of mining. And we need to tell those kind of stories. But we also need to be shocked by the sorts of things that go on and not be paralyzed by it. We're going to need to cut this off. I have one hand here from Seth, and then we're going to take a quick break. And then
I just want to come back to some comment on that. Often the benefits of communities are different from individuals, and the costs are borne by, especially with these externalities. And at least with those churches that I've been involved, they've gotten much more involved in social issues than they have in environmental issues. And I think this kind of links in with that, is that if you start to look at this as a social issue, not just an environmental issue. That's one way to really engage a much broader set of the Christian community. But there's a very strong social component to this that has to be addressed. It's not really an environmental issue.
That's right. Folks here need to make a living, and with this kind of mining and shifting from the old kind of mining, far fewer people are benefiting from this kind of mining, and far more people are being hurt by it. But the bottom line, for the financial perspective, maybe looks better.
Right. But I think that's one way to engage a much larger set of Christians.
So you turn this into a question of human flourishing again, and not just of being a tree hugger.
Right. In a much broader sense.
That's right. Why don't we take a 5-minute break?